super fond of Tom Armitage, but I'm not going to... That's actually all I have to say about him. So I just wanted to clear that. So let's go. Years ago, that's what the future looked like. Like now, like 2 minutes from now, and it's going to be awesome. To make the point, I actually prepared part of the presentation in the kind of augmented reality layer situated in this room right now. So if you have any of these right now, layer, Wikitude, Zip Reality, Metro AR Pro, Bionic Eye, Robot Vision, Work Snug, Mscape. These are the top 9 augmented reality apps. Try it out. And if not you, then who? And let's say I really had done that. Let's say I was offering $1,000, which is still worth something, a little bit. Let's say I had done that. And let's say you had those on your phone. Where would you look at? How would you know where to direct that? And what would happen when the signal cut out, like it does when you talk on your phone? What would happen when you lost the GPS signal, which is like what happens? And if everything was hot, let's just say everything was hot. Let's say the whole world really was as hot as it looks in that video. How would you know what to actually point at? Right? This is the question. I mean, one way to solve it is just to put markers on everything. And that's a lot less sexy, isn't it? Right? Like, we'll make it magic by putting stickers on it. Right? We'll put, you know, all these magic layers with a piece of paper. I don't really see it. And the question is, what would you have to have to use it? Would you all have to have the same thing? If not you, then who? And what would it take to make you care about any of that? So, hi. I'm what's between you and alcohol right now for like the next 40 minutes. And that may or may not be true in general. But for these next 30 or 40 minutes, this is what we're going to talk about. I'm going to kind of interrogate augmented reality. And I mean like American-style interrogation. Because it's not really about how far away we are from it. Because we all know, if you've ever actually tried it, if you've ever tried to keep a conversation going on a phone, let alone a steady stream video with GPS and a compass and a data signal, you know that's not going to happen, right? You know that's not going to happen. But this isn't about that. This isn't about how far away we are. This is, I mean, there's part of me that just wants to make sure that when all of you go home to wherever that is, you say, yeah, look, for the shampoo account, we're not going to do the augmented reality game anymore, right? The tree up which we were barking bears no fruit. But I'm more interested about why we want to go there in the first place, like what it is. In the same ways that, like, we all wanted to go to Second Life 10 years ago, except nobody did. There's something that's interesting about the fact that we all want to go here now, about the fact that these videos keep getting made, these pitches keep getting pitched, and these applications keep getting built. And what I'm interested in is why we want to go there and what that says about us and where we can go instead and what we can learn along the way. So this is a story that it's like 20 years old about some stuff that happened 65 years ago. And so there's all kinds of distortion in there because also my memory is bad. So about half of what I'm going to tell you is true in this story. And it was a story told to me by a photography professor I had about 20 years ago, a guy named Norman. And Norman had been on an aircraft carrier during the Second World War. And he had that job that you see in movies about the Second World War. You know, there's like that big glass board there, and there's like the guy who's like writing, you know, this is where the zeros are, or this is where the ships are. So that was his job. And that's a really difficult job because, in fact, what he's looking at, and you can see it just to the right of the figure there, of the guy, he's looking at a little radar signal, right? Very early radar. And he's got to draw it immediately up on the big board. And people will live or die depending on the accuracy and the speed at which he can translate what's on that little monitor up onto the big board. And the thing that's difficult about this is that the translation he has to do is to make it upside down and backwards. The information that he was getting off the radar screen was upside down and backwards relative to what it had to be for the captain of the ship who was on the other side of that green, of the big screen. So that's actually sort of hard to do immediately, instinctively, accurately. So they sent Norman to school, the Navy. They sent him to town. And there were a whole bunch of towns built in the United States during the Second World War to kind of optimize behaviors and instincts for the war. And the little town that they sent Norman to was basically upside down and backwards town. And upside down and backwards town, he was there for 3 weeks, let's say, and everything in it was upside down and backwards. They had upside down and backwards newspaper, upside down and backwards signs, so on and so forth. And he said that it took a few weeks to be able to read like that. It took a few weeks for the Navy to train his brain to see the world the way that they needed him to see it. And, you know, I'm not sure how much of that story is true, but I picture that place, upside down and backwards town, when I think about ourselves and our future in so-called augmented reality. Because the question is, was Norman's upside down and backwards town any more or less real than the image that we have of Brighton, of London, of New York? Is that actually any more accurate than the ways that we see to begin with? So in 1929, Jean Piaget was working with a bunch of children, and I think you all know generally who Piaget was, psychologist, cognitive psychologist, and he was working with a bunch of children, and he discovered that they had a very strange idea about the world, as children do, what he called extramission. That children have, if you kind of press them on it, as Piaget was never afraid of doing, if you press them on it, children will describe the role of the eye as something that kind of paints the world in front of it. In other words, that somehow something comes out of the eye and kind of renders the world in front of us. And that's called emission theory. And if it seems childish, you know, the thing to consider is that this was the dominant model for conceiving of vision until 1021, and it was disproved by Ibn al-Thayyam. So Plato, Euclid, these were their models for vision, that the world is essentially rendered, right, by kind of rays that sort of shoot out of the eye, that the world is somehow painted by the eye. And there was this study in 2002 in the United States with college students. And they found, and this is college students in the United States, and they found that about 50% of them still believe this. Okay? 50% believe that the world is rendered by the eye. And, you know, of course, that's crazy. And there's a sort of clear and modern alternative, and it's called intromission theory. And that's sort of what, you know, a physicist would tell you, a neurologist would tell you, that the retina basically detects photons in the world, and it causes neural impulses to travel to the brain and so on and so forth. But the thing is that you can explain that to American college students, and they will still, they still won't believe you. And this is also, they also believe this about, you know, creation and but this is, in a way, part of that, right? That in spite of overwhelming evidence that the world is actually absorbed somehow, there's this desire to kind of paint it. So it was easier to retrain Norman's eyes in Upside Down and Backwards Town than it is to get an American college student to understand that the world is seen the way that we see it. So vision is basically, it's thought of as directed outwards in this model, like away from the self, like towards specific objects. And if you understand the world like American college students do, then it's only natural. It's only natural to kind of augment reality by adding a few layers between it. So augmented reality and AR, they're part of the 2010 vernacular, the 2011 vernacular, but they're, you know, the words are only about 20 years old. There were ideas before that, but the phrase was coined by a guy named Tom Caudill, and he was working at Boeing, funded by DARPA. And he was working on a very specific problem, and it's an interesting problem, which is what you see on the left is how they used to run the wiring for bombers and fighters. There's a couple miles worth of wire inside of an airplane. So they would make kind of boards that would show, for the workers, wires go like this. And the problem with that is, you see how far back that goes, right? You basically have to have a couple miles of boards, you know, so that they can kind of like work down the line, building these, turning these sort of diagrams into the reality, into the kind of neurological mass inside the fighter. And so Caudill thought, well, what if the person who's assembling the wire just had kind of a blank canvas in front of them, and that they themselves, they could see the diagram and just change it, you know, as they needed to. And so that's one of the earliest ones right there on the right. That's doing the same job, and you can see how much less space that takes. You can see how, you can imagine how much more efficient that is. So augmented reality, what you see, you know, he's sort of looking at the diagrams, it starts with building machines to fly. It starts with cables running up into the helmet. So the photo on the right is from 1995. And if you look at this picture, you see a guy hooked up to a bunch of wires that terminated his eyes, and then there's another bunch of wires that terminated his fingertips. And he's building the nervous system for a Boeing airplane. He's building the world on a blueprint that's visible only to him. So his eyes make that blueprint real. And he's following a program written by Boeing. And in real terms, augmented reality starts here. 1984, James Cameron did this movie you might have heard of. It's called The Terminator. It's probably just a coincidence that it starred the governor of California who bankrupted a lot of the companies that I'll be mentioning right here. Stars a cyborg assassin sent through time from a post-apocalypse 2029. And of course, the cyborg, to outward appearances, looks like a human. On the inside, like all computing machines, right? It's just, it's metal and it's wire and it's a bunch of algorithms. And there's sensing apparata. There's like sophisticated optics, which you can see when his head gets blown apart. And the thing that's curious, you see this in the movie, there's a couple moments where it switches to the Terminator point of view. And we get to see how the Terminator thinks. And the Terminator has this kind of AR hot display, right? It's one of the first cinematic representations here of how machines see the world, or an early one. It's an early representation of how machines see the world. So the Terminator sees the reality that we see, but he sees a lot more than we see. Right? He sees this sort of steady stream of text superimposed on the raw optical imagery. And so the machine sees the world like that worker at Boeing saw the world, right? Looking at data in front of him. And what's curious is that it's using text, right? Like a computer needs to read, right? I mean, it's weird, right? As if a computer needs to write something to remind itself through reading it optically, like... and if you learn from Los Angeles in 1984, vision, right, the idea that vision is so singularly important that a microprocessor, right, that a robot would be unable to respond without eyes to read the text that it's writing, right? It's kind of weird. And this is the fallacy of augmented reality, because it asserts that the eye and not the brain is the unified center of perception and thought and reality, right? It says that the eye is where things actually happen. And there are places where the brain and the eye are the same thing. Did you guys catch this, right? Kind of made the rounds a couple days ago. This is a Polish driver who basically set up some SQL instructions in his license plate because the traffic cameras are, of course, scanning the license plates, right? It's a good idea. It's a really good idea. Whether this makes the car any less likely to be pulled over is up for debate. But, right, this speaks to this kind of Terminator vision of the world, the Terminator vision of the world, right, where the actually, we're seeing and doing are the same thing, right? Because as far as a traffic camera is concerned, there's no distinction between seeing the thing and executing the thing, right? That's a closed loop. And the thing that's amazing about humans is that there's a lot more stuff going on in there, right? And that you can look at that and understand, well, this is clearly an exploit, right? In a way that a traffic camera can't. And it's a joke, but it's not fiction. It's a little parable about writing to the world in a kind of machine dialect. Right? But we don't run that, right? Humans don't run machine dialect. We can speak it, but that doesn't mean that we're running it. Between the eye and the database sort of inside our skull, there's just a lot more going on. Okay, so this is a Total Immersion. I think it's a French company, I'm not sure. I think so. Total Immersion said, okay, you know what would make baseball cards magic? Would be if you use the front of the card as a kind of AR surface, so that when you hold it up in front of your computer, your phone, whatever it's going to be, that the player actually comes to life, right? And you can see it there on the screen. So in Rules of Play, which is a book by Katie Salen and Eric Zimmerman about games, they outline an argument for what they call the immersive fallacy. Excuse me for a second. And they say, the immersive fallacy. They say, the idea, all right, this is Katie and Eric, the idea that the pleasure of a media experience lies in its ability to sensually transport the participant into an illusory simulated reality. According to the immersive fallacy, this reality is so complete that ideally the frame falls away so the player truly believes that he or she is part of an imaginary world. Right? That's what you see going on in that fantasy of the Emscape video from HP from 5 years ago, and it's what you see going on here. Right? In augmented reality, the proposal is that immersion, that reality, is most effectively transformed through something that's mimetic, something that looks more like the player. Right? It's because it's 3D, so it's more. It's like 2D, but more. And so, you know, it's the idea that this is what makes the card come alive, as if the 3D model of the player has more life in it than the whole back of the card, which has 15 years of statistics for the player, right? As if that is less of a portrait than this. And so Salen and Zimmerman, they cite this studies, a film studies scholar, Elena Gorfinkel, and she says, the confusion in this conversation has emerged because representational strategies are conflated with the effect of immersion. Immersion itself is not tied to a replication or mimesis of reality. Right? That the idea, like what the thing that we've all bought or sold, is that if we make it look more like the real world, it becomes more real. And that's the fallacy, right? It's true in games, it's true in AR. And in fact, they often make things less real. And it's a phenomenon that's well known to roboticists. And there's this, you know, you guys probably know this already, right? The so-called uncanny valley, right? That what happens when things are totally human over on the right, we're totally comfortable with that. something that looks like an industrial robot, like the ones that make cars or the ones that clean your floors, totally comfortable with that. That stuff in the middle, right, where it's, you know, it's like they're robots that have eyes and they, you know, they start to have some human qualities but some robot qualities, it's deeply unsettling for most people. You know, like nobody wants to date one. Almost nobody. And they call that, you know, the roboticists, among others, call that the uncanny valley. And as we aspire to these kind of lenses, you know, these lenses or these lenses that kind of render the world in front of us, we're at this weird frontier of that valley, right? Not for the human face, not for the robot, but for the actually the world around us, right? The valley between kind of barely real and fully real starts to extend out into the world itself. And these companies like Layar and Wikitude, they propose to kind of augment the streets around us with kind of imports from this region. And so the uncanny valley will finally have kind of real-world geography, real-world citizens who are further and further from home. In the superimposition between the things that are real and the things that we want to say about the things that are real, and actually superimposing those on the eye, as opposed to just providing information to synthesize back here in the database, right? Those impulses, I argue, they make the city feel further and further away. Because if you think about it like from the baseball card metaphor, right? What makes the player real is what's on the other side of the card, right? This is Nick Felton's annual report from 2010. I don't think I have to explain it. This is the portrait of his father, composed not, of course, of images, but rather of the tiny pieces of data that his father left behind. And he sews these together, right? 22 homes from the 60s. And in this, his father lives forever, in this data, in this portrait, right? And it's not about making the invisible visible, right? It's about learning to actually work with the material of the invisible, right? Learning to find ways to make that real. And I ask you, as a stranger, what carries that memory further? Is it the photograph, or is it actually the sort of the care in the assembly of the data, in the editorial quality through which the data is interpreted, that tell us more about what he did and who he was? So those stats on the back of the baseball card, those should tell us a lot more. Those should bring a lot more life to the world than some kind of flimsy digital puppet. It's not news, right? We've been doing this for as long as we've had other eyes to see with, right? The Cottingley Fairies, 1920, starts in 1917. Every piece of these were the, I don't know what everybody knows, but obviously the photographs that were produced shortly after the First World War, documenting evidence of fairy activity here in the UK. And every piece of technology we've ever, and I mean, these were documentation, right? This wasn't fantastic. This wasn't like the Emscape video. This was like the nightly news from fairyland. You know, every piece of technology we've ever had has sort of fueled this dream. You know, any time we've invented something that serves the eye, we've used that thing to trick the eye. There's something gratifying about that. And we sort of want to conflate the practice of imagining with the act of documenting. Somehow, we need that. And that's fair enough, right? To imagine the world filled with things that we can't see, it's a nice idea, especially if they're benevolent, like fairies, right? Less like germs or terrorists. And Arthur Conan Doyle talks about the Cottingley Fairies. He says, this is 1920, he says, the recognition of their existence will jolt the material 20th century mind out of its heavy ruts in the mud, and it will make it admit that there's a glamour and a mystery to life. Right? Like, it's really, you know, he could really be talking about that Emscape video that we saw at the beginning. But it's not just glamour and mystery, right? It's also comfort. So the Cottingley ferries arrived on film at the end of World War I. These are the photographs done by Mumler. These are spirit photographs. These were done 1860. He starts. This is right after the American Civil War. And you could sit for a portrait, and he would photograph you and the spirits of the dead, because everybody lost somebody. And the spirits of the dead would appear on the film, right? This is Lincoln's widow, who sat, and then magically Lincoln appeared on the negative. And, you know, like the Cottingley fairies, you know, Mumler was eventually denounced and ultimately prosecuted. And I was looking at some stuff from the trial. It's like, you know that you're in trouble when the prosecution against you is P.T. Barnum, right? The prosecution against you is P.T. Barnum accusing Mumler, who made this photograph, as taking advantage of people. Okay? P.T. Barnum says that about you. It's time to seriously reconsider your approach. Right? We use the camera, like the film camera, to see fairies and dead men. So what are we hoping to see with AR? And more importantly, the bigger question is, why do we look to optics to provide wonder or comfort in the first place? So here, part of it is that I just wanted to have a video of Muppets so that it's not all like dead guys and airplanes, right? But it's also because of what the Muppets were about. And this was a really good short essay by Elizabeth Stevens sent to me by my friend Tom. And it's an essay about Kermit the Frog. And I guess the most important part of this is she says, there's a couple of things that there, you know, that there's the scenes look homely as craft projects, right? Henson knew that the feeling of realism does not require verisimilitude or loveliness, but rather the movement of life, the constant movement of body and voice. And then at the end, what matters in the Muppet universe isn't perfection, but expression. Dancing across the screen, they embody the philosophy, this is the key point, that it is not what you look like that matters, but what you do. Right? And I think it's a very weird thing for designers to get designer heads around, but it's the truth, right? That it's not what things look like that matter, it's what they do. And in AR, you see this sort of movement backwards. I'm interested in the movement forwards, right? So the effects of the Tamagotchi were super well documented when they happened in 1996. Think about when this was happening. Right? Tamagotchi comes out right at the time of the first wave of 3D video games, right? Super Mario 64, Duke Nukem 3D, Tomb Raider, etc. So the obvious trend in video games at that moment, like the race, was polygon count, right? Higher polygon count meant greater realism, greater verisimilitude, greater mimetic qualities, and that's what would make games better. And then this came out, right? And they sold 70 million units? Yeah, 70 million units. Okay. And in Hawaii, they banned them because it disrupted school and all kinds of things. But the amazing thing is that this was immersive, right? It was actually immersive. It was so immersive that it was banned in schools. And that the immersion was produced through an 8x8 matrix of these, you know, of like, you know, basically lo-fi emoticons in a way, right? And it didn't aspire to mimetic visual representation. It became real by behaving real, right? The Tamagotchi became real by behaving real. And what it meant to be real was to be hungry, to be rewarding, to be vulnerable, to be sick. And with the senses of time and obligation, right, of knowing that this thing in your pocket actually needed you, that produced a much deeper sense that this thing was actually alive. So within that, you see that the aspiration to kind of 3D optical augmented reality starts to feel like a kind of pornography, you know, like a thin veneer of the actual experience, you know, just flattened for the eye, which is the sense that's most easily tricked to begin with. This is This is a game that we did in 2006. I used to have a company called Area Code. We did a lot of the early location-based games, etc. This was a game called Crossroads. This was a two-player game in which the two players, represented by the sun and the moon, are moving through crossroads of lower Manhattan. And in a half-hour game, the number of crossroads that you had actually taken by running through them, whoever had the most crossroads at the end of the half hour won. It's a two-player game. You could see yourself, you could see your opponent, but you could also see, and you can see the little skull up there, you could also see Papa Bones. Papa Bones is a spirit that we sort of drew up from New Orleans on shortly after Hurricane Katrina. Papa Bones is a spirit that only exists in the game, but has geography the same way you do, right? So you see where you are, and you see where your opponent is, and I saw this happen, right, that and I have done this myself. You know, when you see that your opponent is further up Leroy Street, you instinctively look up to confirm that. That's sort of hardwired into the human firmware. It's also true that when you see that Papa Bones is coming at you from the left, you also look up to see that too. And so what you see in these players here is people who are running down Hudson Street being pursued by something invisible. And I think the important part was keeping the thing that was invisible, invisible. And there was a moment when we were playtesting this, when we were like working on it. So this was 5 years ago, and it was really, really difficult to work with GPS phones, and I hate thinking about that, actually. There was a moment where we had all of the tester phones up on a table, and they were designed, if Papa Bones crossed your path, the phone would vibrate, right, in your hand, right? Except we had all the tester phones on a table, and we were coding some stuff, and I don't know what we were thinking about, and it was probably about 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was a moment where Papa Bones swept through the studio, and all the phones just vibrated and fell off the desk. And nothing, I mean, nobody knows better than I do that that's just raw code, right? But the idea that something had somehow swept through, the idea that that had physical force to push those phones off the table, I was completely unprepared for what that would feel like. That, I think, is like the weight of the invisible when it's actually augmented. Right? That's the weight of reality when it actually has some magic in it. So this is Momo. This is a project by Seiwei Wang and Kristen Ofriel from ITP, the school in New York. It's called Momo. It's what they call a haptic navigation device. So what they write about it, they say, it's a haptic navigation device that requires only the sense of touch to guide a user. No maps, no text, no arrows, no lights. It sits on the palm of one's hand and leans, vibrates, and gravitates towards a preset location. Akin to someone pointing you in the right direction, there's no need to find your map. You simply follow as the device leans towards your destination. And in Momo, you know, we see this alternative and I think optimistic path to augmenting reality. Right? So Google Maps, if you think about it, you know, when what you're doing when you look at that, you know, it shows you your world from above and then it draws a line for the route. And conventional AR says actually you do this and you're looking through a lens to see where you're going. And Momo augments the sense of reality and location with the body instead of the eye. So the user's sort of pushed softly by an object that's in her hands. And she's sort of nudged rather than directed. But most importantly, it's that her eyes are restored to their original function, which is taking in the world around her. Right? Not the world right in front of her, but the world around her. Because that's what these are for. So most stories of technology and the dreams of technologies, they either begin or end with the military in some way, and AR is no different, as I mentioned. And some of the earliest and maybe the most useful applications of it are to helmet-mounted displays, HMDs for fighter pilots. So up there on the left, that's for the AH-64 pilots. And if you understand emission theory, right, like that childhood vision of the world, like that half of all college students' vision of the world, if emission theory is true, right, that there are rays that shoot from the eye, this made that true, right? Because the idea was we will actually make the eye the operational instrument, okay? And that the rays that shoot from the eye now are Hellfire missiles, right? And if you look at what's happened, you know, in the transition, so that's an F-35 pilot on the right, and you see the F-35 pilot for what he is, right, which is the slowest part of the plane, right, the most fallible sort of part of the plane. You see him for what he is, which is basically a giant eyeball, right, a huge eyeball strapped to a bunch of supporting hardware, you know, but it's an eyeball with agency, and it's strapped to a body that's strapped to the plane. And it's super effective for pilots, right? This idea that what they look at is the thing that they can act on, and they can act by looking. It's super effective for pilots because they're traveling at Mach 1, right? There's no time to think, right? And in many ways, for pilots, there is no reality except for the reality directly in front of them. Just that. And so everybody wants to play with this, right? Everybody says, well, if it's good for American pilots, it's probably good for the American driver because there's more of them. And so in 1994, Michael Flanagan and Andrew Harrison published their study, The Effects of Automobile Head-Up Display Location for Younger and Older Drivers. And there have been a lot of attempts to kind of like bring this kind of AR pilot technology into the automobile itself. That's what you see here is the Peugeot 3008, like that's up and running. For the most part, these experiments have radically underperformed or failed because the driver is really different than the pilot and has more to do, I think, with how we move through the world. For the driver, their sense of the world is gained not just by what they're focused on, right? It's not about this thing that's right there, but what lies in the periphery, right? Like what actually catches their eye over here. And for the driver, reality is not augmented by drawing greater focus to the single point straight ahead. Singular focus, in which the eye looks at rather than around, it kind of diminishes reality, right? It kind of shuts it down. Because as it turns out that, you know, for the driver, as for the rest of us, reality is understood to be the whole world around us, not just the world in front of us. In the Second World War, they gave Norman the tools that they needed to give him to shift the way that he saw the world. Those tools, they didn't change what he saw. They just changed how he saw it. And this, I think, is the noble purpose facing designers of the future. Right. The principles and the goals of augmenting reality, right? Specifically, of using technology to enhance or alter the perception of reality, they may not best be expressed by designing stuff to look at. So the artists, Chris Wobkin and Kenichi Okada, they designed Animal Superpowers. This is from 2008. They did a series of them. This one's called Ant Apparatus, and I'll read you what they wrote about. They say, it allows you to feel like an ant by magnifying your vision 50 times through microscope antennas in your hand. You can perceive all the tiny cracks and details of a surface through this. It allows you to see through your hands and to dive into a secret and hidden world. That's what they write about it. So reality is augmented. I mean, this is sort of genuine magic. Right? Reality is augmented, but not by adding a layer, not by making stuff to look at, but about making something different to see with. You know, to feel the world, the real world, in sort of ways that we've never known how to feel it. These guys are the astronauts on Earth, right? They re-explore this planet that none of us are ever going to leave. They invent these new ways to see rather than new things to look at, because really, there's no shortage of stuff to look at already, because reality is plenty. Thanks.